This episode of Motherhood in Hollywood is sponsored by Kinsa, the world's smartest thermometer. When my daughter Channing is sick, I turn to my Kinsa smart thermometer for peace of mind. It remembers her temperature, symptoms, and medication, so I don't have to. And it even lets me send it to her doctor. Get your own Kinsa at kinsahealth.com. Motherhood in Hollywood is also sponsored by BumbyBox, an eco-friendly toy subscription service your kids will love. Each Bumby Box comes with fun, play-based toys and activities specially chosen for your child. And if you enter the code MIHOOD at checkout, you'll get 10% off. What a deal! Go to BumbyBox.com and find out why Bumby Box is a better way to play.
Come on, Mama!
Grab your popcorn and goobers. It's time for Motherhood in Hollywood with your host, Heather Brooker. This is a crude prude's perspective on being a full-time mom in showbiz. She's not a perfect mom, but she can play one on TV. Hold on to your butts. Here's Heather.
Hello, friends and family of Motherhood in Hollywood. It's me, Heather. Welcome to episode 40. What if I did every episode like that? Now, listen here, see? It's the 1940s, and we're here to talk about podcasting and a little bit of news. What do you think about that? I'm pretty sure you guys would send me emails like, fucking stop it, you're insane. It would get a little annoying after a while, so I won't, I promise. I'll just throw it in every now and then. It's episode 40. I have a great guest on today. So my friend is coming on today. His name's Travis Oates. Travis is the voice of Piglet for Winnie the Pooh, and he's done like the TV shows and movies. He also is a writer and producer. He also does what's called punch-up work for feature films and television shows, and I'll let him explain a little bit about what's involved with that. And we talk about everything from like our, you know, their love of geekdom, and how he grew up in Canada. He was a child star in Canada, friends with a lot of huge celebrities here in Hollywood. But as often happens, sometimes you see the people around you and your friends like shooting up to stardom, you know, getting their own shows, starring in major movies, and you're sitting in your office doing a podcast. What? Hashtag grateful. Anyway, so he talks a little bit about the anonymity and frustrations that sometimes come along with being a writer and director. Lots of good stuff packed into this episode today. I want to remind everybody that I am going to be appearing on Lopez, I think, this week. The week this episode comes out on April 6th. You know, you never know. I'm always hesitant to kind of tell people, hey, watch for me on this show or that show, because I have been burned so many times. I've actually shot quite a few TV shows. I was on The Office twice, but it never aired like in prime time because they cut me out for time. The Office like way overshot a lot of their stuff. They let their actors improvise and whatnot. So twice I told everybody I knew, oh my God, I'm going to be in The Office. And it didn't happen. My episode of The Office still airs in reruns. The one I did where Jim and Pam have a baby, it's called The Delivery Part 1. It still airs in reruns like on TBS and, you know, stuff like that. So people, I'm still seen, but it's just super embarrassing to tell everyone that you're going to be on a huge show and then it doesn't actually happen. So my hope and my understanding is that on April 6th, I'm going to be on Lopez on TV Land. It's a really fun part. Check it out. Tweet at me at MIH Podcast or at Heather Brooker. I also have my personal Heather Brooker Twitter that I forget about sometimes. I'll just randomly go on there and put inappropriate comments just so I make sure I'm still over there. But I see you guys on at Heather Brooker. But I mostly focus on MIH Podcast now. What else? Oh, Spring Fest is coming up. That is a fun event for moms and dads and new parents to go and check out the latest and greatest in baby products. I'm going to be stopping by there. So if you want to come, let me know. I'll put a little blurb on it on my website. What else? I'm sure there's like 1,000 things. Oh, the MIH 15. I just totally whistle talked. Sorry. It's weird. Sometimes I do that. It's a weird habit I have. You guys have weird habits, right? No, just me. What the hell was I talking about? Oh, MIH 15 by 15. So I have a month now to lose the 15 pounds that I had set for myself, the goal of 15 pounds by my 15th wedding anniversary. And although I feel like I'm doing well, I'm still not where I want to be. So I'm really going to be buckling down this next month. I go to the gym intermittently between my fun workouts that I do, like the cool things around town that I'm doing. But I also still go to the gym in the in-between. So just so you guys know. But I'm just frustrated because I'm not, you know, I want a flat stomach and I want, you know, a smaller butt. But it's just, it's not happening. And I know that aside from probably like working out 2 hours a day, which I don't have the time to do, you know, I don't know how people get there. Maybe they start off there. Maybe. Anyway, I'm still striving. My point is I'm still striving, even though the struggle is real. I want pizza like in my face right now. The struggle is real, but I'm not giving up. I have a goal. I've set a very public goal and I intend to reach it. So there's that. If you're also doing the MIH 15 by 15 along with me, you should know that I'm going to be giving out a really cool prize at the end for those of you who are doing the 15 by 15 with me. If you want to tweet at me or post about it on my Facebook page and say, hey, I want it on that prize, I'll pick a random winner and you guys will get a really cool gift from me for doing the MIH 15 by 15 with me. Okay, so I want to keep my mommy monologue short today because I want to get right to my guests. We have so much to talk about, so many cool things. Travis used to be my director in improv and sketch here in Los Angeles many, many moons ago, pre-Channing days. So you'll get to hear us talk a lot about the state of improv and sketch comedy in Hollywood today. So much good stuff. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Here's my interview with writer and director Travis Oates. Just a moment ago, you were saying that I was your favorite person ever to direct at Acme Comedy Theater. That's right.
That's right. That's okay. Right. Yeah. I comment on that all the time.
Right. Exactly. Travis Oates is here, writer, director, extraordinaire. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking me to come out.
Now, you have a baby.
I do have a baby.
He's not a baby anymore, though. He's
no.
a big boy.
In fact, he insists that he's not a baby.
Oh.
We used to do a thing where we would, you know, kind of Zerbert his tummy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that I was getting his baby belly. And then about a good solid year ago, he said, Daddy, I'm not a baby.
He's like, stop doing
yeah.
that.
Now it's his boy belly.
Does he call himself a big boy?
He calls himself boy, which is kind of an interesting thing. In fact, the other day we had a play date and it was two little girls and he kept saying, thank you, boy, to the girls.
Yeah.
And we realized he doesn't know gender at all.
No, Channing's doing the same thing. She says she mixes up he and she a lot.
Yeah. And so I asked him, I said, now what are you? Are you? And he says, I'm a boy. And I says, okay, is daddy a boy? And he says, no, daddy's a man.
Oh, and you were like, damn right.
Exactly. And then I said, well, is what's mommy? And he looked at mommy and said, a person, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
And same with Grammy. Grammy's a person. But no concept of girl. I said, is she a girl? And he said, no, she's a person. Which either he is strictly for, like he's a feminist at two. Or
like,
that's just his perception.
Don't label my mommy.
Exactly.
She's a person.
She's not a girl. She's a person. So
that's hilarious. Yeah. Now, you stay at home and work most of the time, right?
I do. I'm kind of Mr. Mom right
You are
now.
Mr. Mom. Yeah. And how's that going?
Oh, I love it. I mean, I I would like if it held that way. I mean, the only problem is I can't direct and be at home.
Right.
And I wouldn't want to go another two full years without directing something. But
right.
It's an ideal situation for having a child.
Mm-hmm.
I think my wife misses being home. We both took the first year off of his childhood, so we were both home for the first year. But then she went back to work, and she has a fairly intense job that takes her. In fact, she'll be going to Washington, D.C., I think, for a week
cool.
coming up here. And so she doesn't get as much home time. And I love it. I mean,
yeah.
It's fascinating to watch how he progresses and how he evolves
as a person.
Yeah, it's very odd.
Literally, you can see them becoming people and like what they're going to be like, ideally, little nuggets of it. Hopefully they're not like to right. that extreme sometimes, but like little nuggets of their personality. You're like, oh my gosh, you're going to be like a really cool person, you know, or man, you're going to be a butthole.
Right. You know? Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not only does it warm your heart as a parent, but it's a fascinating thing as a writer mm-hmm. to watch the evolutionary process of how he discovers things and what he considers important and the concepts that he gloms onto. Just, you know, like I said, not understanding gender is something that I hadn't even recognized until recently. But the things he does get early mm-hmm. and the things that he doesn't, like no concept of it's interesting that children at that age have no concept of race or gender. And there are things that you can see directly, like I did that. Like you can see he's ridiculously polite, and that's something definitely that we
reinforced
because we always say whenever he does anything, we thank him for it, and we say please and thank you all the time to him, and so he reflects them back. And even when he's angry and he gets really upset, and you know he gets into the no face, he'll go no thanks, daddy,
no thanks. Thank you. Yeah, Channing no, thanks. Will go no thank you.
Exactly. So he's angry but still polite. Like, and you look at that and you go, okay, I get that. I get why he's doing that, and I know that I'm a part of that. But then there are other things. He's into trains. Crazy for trains.
Really?
Crazy for trains. That comes from nowhere. I
you're not a big train guy?
I'm not. I never have been. I'm like his grandfather was into trains, but great grandfather. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was into trains. But he wouldn't know that or have any he's not even around with us anymore. For Christmas, because he had his first real Christmas, he's 2 years old, so he understood Christmas a little bit better and understood presents. And so for Christmas, we decided, well, we're new parents too, so I'm sure you did this too. We way overspent.
Oh, for sure.
For his first Christmas.
Yeah.
Just because, we just want him to have, you know, happy face and
yeah, we went open nuts. Presents. We like got her own apartment.
I know.
I mean, we were like, whatever you need.
Exactly.
And I was like, I don't really know. Maybe she needs all this.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so I decided to do the whole thing with the train going around the tree, because I'd always seen that and I'd never experienced
classic.
That. So I was like, okay, let's go old school. So Lego makes a train because he loves Lego, not Duplo. He can't stand Duplo, but he loves Lego.
Snob.
But Lego had a train, and it was really more for adults because it was a complex set. But it had a train, and I said, okay, so, have this Lego train going around the tree. And so he comes into the room, and he sees the train, and he goes right to it, and he's just fascinated by it. And it's going around in a circle, then I say, okay, son, you want to open a present? And he says, no, thank you, Daddy, train. Uh-huh. And I said, okay. Now, son, seriously.
Meanwhile,
like,
you have tens of thousands
literally,
of dollars worth of
I mean, just,
toys
I'm
and
just
presents.
Like tons of stuff. Well, you know, honey, you should. No, thank you, Daddy. Had no interest in anything
just
else.
Just one of the trains.
Just the train. Played with that train and that train alone for until 2 o'clock in the morning. Just took the train with him everywhere. And then 3 days went by because it was not a little kid train. So it was hard to put on the tracks. Uh-huh. 3 days went by of. Daddy train on the track, mommy train on track, of like every 5 minutes for 3 days. And finally we were like,
oh,
I don't care
gosh.
How much we just spent on Christmas. I don't care how little he played with any of it. We have to go find a train that he can put back on the tracks.
Have you
himself.
Gone to Travel Town?
Well, we haven't gone to Travel Town yet, but we got him a Thomas, train.
That's table. How annoying is that song?
Oh, well,
it just loops in my brain.
Well, now he's train crazy because, like, we had no mm-hmm. idea, and I still don't know where he got it. He just recently saw his first real train tracks. Mm-hmm. We were traveling, we stopped, and he went out and saw the real train tracks, and he gave them a kiss.
Oh,
he really was very excited.
There is something about little boys and trains, though. They're very, like, one of my friends, Eleanor, who has a little boy, loves trains. Like, yeah, he's super into it. There must just be something about them that little boys connect with.
I guess, because the show is creepy as hell. The Thomas show, I mean, the faces look...
They're weird. They're so weird. Look
at the same time plastic and yet super realistic.
Yeah.
Like they're, it is like really frightening. Like
pushing through skin, yeah, and talking.
Yeah, it's really scary looking, mm-hmm, at first, I think. But yeah. And they're kind of all dicks.
Yeah,
like the trains, yeah, like I know they're trying to teach, here's things that you shouldn't do,
but and, they're kind of moral nasty to each other,
moral lessons, mm-hmm, to one another. And it's kind of strangely fascist, like the guy who runs the place owns all the trains, right?
Right.
And then he, it's the whole thing
Mr.
of
Topham,
like
Hat?
Yeah, Mr. Topham Hat, mm-hmm, and it, the biggest compliment is you're a very useful engine, and it's like, so if he's not a useful engine,
he's out.
He's like scrap.
He's out.
It's just kind of like weirdly, mm-hmm, Mussolini-esque, you know. The trains are running on time.
It's made in England, so maybe there's some like leftover World War II animosity.
I don't know. It's kind of
whichever one. I'm horrible at history. Whichever one Mussolini was in.
Mussolini, Italy.
World War One.
World War Two.
Oh, World War Two. Okay, so I got.
Well,
the
he
war
wasn't
right.
Technically. I mean, that's why Italy dropped out of World War Two. Yeah.
I was like,
but Mussolini was technically at the beginning part of the Axis powers.
History on the podcast. I'm terrible at history. I love it. And if we talked about English Tudor history, I could talk about that for days.
Well, see, I was educated in Canada, so.
Oh, yeah, Canada.
Historical.
I forget, you're a huge star in Canada, right?
in my day, but not anymore. I mean, the show that I was on was a long-running show, but it's not on anymore.
But it was like the You Can't Do That on Television of Canada. Right?
No, You Can't Do That on Television was the You Can't Do That of Television of Canada. That was
filmed in Canada?
Filmed in Canada, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I was almost on that show. I was on, I very, very, came very close to being on that show, and we made the decision to make my team at the time decided rather than doing that show, I would go make a movie in Nicaragua. And I look back at that, and And the movie was a very prestigious film, but probably would have done more for my career if I'd
done the slime show.
Yeah, the slime show. And I would have got to know Alanis Morissette.
I know. How cool would that be? She wasn't on for very long, though, right?
No, but she would have been on at the same time that I was.
You were?
Yeah.
What was the name of your show in Canada?
Beachcombers.
Did you come to L.A. to do acting? Is that what brought you out here?
I came to L.A. Twice. The first time that I came, I was here just in time to be in an earthquake.
Yeah, the Northridge quake?
Yes, the Northridge quake. And I decided that I would go back home then for a while.
So then what led to, after you, you know, left and came back and then came back again, what led to Acme and writing and like sort of what came first there?
Well, I left that first time, and then I went to college for a few years as a music major. And when I was in college, I met a friend of mine named Jeremy, and we started a sketch show together called CIA Comedy in Action, mm-hmm, or Comedians in Agony. And then we got a local origination television show, like a basic cable television show where we were doing sketch comedy on it.
Oh, that's fun. Like Wayne's World, kind of.
No, it was
like sketch.
It was actual sketch. It was, mm-hmm, like, it was like Saturday Night Live, but with no budget.
Oh, all right.
So, and I look back at that, I have some of the tapes from those, and they were pretty bad. I mean, this is way before I had developed my method or any of that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I didn't know what I was doing any more than anybody else does when they start writing sketch. And, you know, it was pretty bad. It was legitimately horrible.
So sketch has been something that you've been doing for some time and involved with in some time in some way.
Well, I should say, to back up, that so the partner that I had there, Jeremy, whose full name is Jeremy Renner, mm-hmm, then went to Hollywood and starred in a film, National Lampoon Senior Trip, although Jeremy Renner probably doesn't like anybody to know that he did that film anymore. But Jeremy Renner,
as in
Hawkeye.
The Hawkeye. Okay, Chris will kill me because I almost called him Arrow.
Yeah.
I would have been like, you probably would have killed me too. Yeah. I was multiple, like, wait, the guy with the arrows?
Multiple Oscar nominee, Jeremy Renner.
He did an early sketch thing with you.
Yeah, he and I were in a sketch. And then he came up here, and when he did his first film, and I called him up and I congratulated him, he said, you know, if I can do this, you can do this. You should come here and I'll help you get set up. Mm-hmm. And so he was instrumental in me coming down the second time.
Yeah.
The second time, that was in 95, I stayed.
Back then, what was the atmosphere like amongst improv schools? Because I don't think there was probably a lot, right? I don't think UCB certainly wasn't here.
UCB wasn't here. Neither was
IO.
IO was in its very beginning state, but it wasn't the IO that you think of now. And there was no Second City either.
So it was literally just the Groundlings.
Well, on this side of the hill, there was Groundlings and Acme, and I think. Theater, Comedy Sports was here, and then Theater Sports was in the Valley, mm-hmm. and also the folks that did the dubbed movies. God, what's their name?
The dubbed movies, the guys that crack jokes in the front.
Yeah,
the puppet thing.
No, not the puppet thing. But this was a show they had in the 70s. And I can't, for the life, they I don't think exist anymore. Mm. I think they went the way of the dodo a while ago. But they also existed. God, what was their name? Boy, I'm completely drawing a blank.
Yeah, I have no idea.
And they actually were a bigger competitor than Theater Sports was, mm-hmm. or Comedy Sports. But yeah, those were, and really they're the only other true. Really, it was just Acme and the Groundlings as far as that level. Because Comedy Sports and Theater Sports weren't really sketch. They were improv. The other folks in the Valley, God, what is their name? It's going to...
Connection Comedy.
Comedy
Connection.
Is it Comedy Connection or Improv There's, Connection?
Yeah, something like that.
Improv Connection, maybe. Something like that. Anyway, they did actual sketch. But they were a racket. They were really all about kind of like how IO does it now. IO went off after their model, mm-hmm. but IO's less of a racket than they were in that they just had all these classes and the classes performed, which is the worst way to learn mm-hmm. improv or sketch, mm-hmm. is to just throw people out there who really don't know anything and just have them do improv in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you had to pay like $120 a month, but that was reduced by $3 for every person you brought in during the month to see, get a ticket.
You're talking about LA Connection Comedy.
LA Connection. Thank you. LA Connection.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, LA Connection. And they were...
They still do that, by the way.
Yeah, and they're horrible. They're horrible. The only sketch or improv organization that I will talk shit about and say don't go to them is LA Connection. LA Connection is a ripoff. They don't teach you anything. Mm-hmm. They're horrible folks there.
Okay.
Yeah. They really are. They're really terrible.
I love
terrible.
You have such strong opinions, Charles.
They really are. They're terrible. And you know, when people would come to placement classes at Acme, I would have nothing but good things to say about the Groundlings or you know, I would say here's the different all the different places, and we had a really good relationship with Comedy Sports and Theater Sports and mm-hmm. But I would always say LA Connection is the only one that I will say
the worst.
Stay away from them. You will learn nothing. They will take a bunch of your money and they're skeevy.
But how did you get into buying and owning Acme? Like, how did that happen?
Well, let's see. I was with Acme, gosh, I don't know how many years, maybe 7 or 8 years. I had moved up to the main company. I had been in the main company a few years. And Cynthia Seghetti left Acme and as the head of the school. So I became head of the school there. And that was when I kind of came up with, I always felt that learning sketch through improv was a really horrible way to learn sketch because I have a writer's background. And mm-hmm. so I was like, well, if you're going to write sketch, you should approach it like you would approach any, you know, you don't tell a screenwriter that the best way to write screenplays is to act in plays. And then that will somehow help you become a screenwriter. That they're not the same. Plays are not the same as screenplays. And acting in one is not the same as sitting down and writing one. So I just thought that that was a terrible method. So I sat down and I'm like, how could you, if I was going to try and teach somebody how to write sketch from a writer's perspective, how would I do that? And I kind of developed the beginnings, at least, of what you eventually took, the sketch program. And it was very different in the beginning. But then when we, M.D. Sweeney, who owned the place before I did, we tried it in the very first class. So in the day, back in the day, we would have a class and they would move up into the company. So he would usually choose two or three people of 20 to move into a company.
Right.
Because that's usually how many people put up good work. So the first class we tried my new method on, he moved all 18 people.
Oh,
because
wow.
Literally there wasn't a bad sketch on the stage. And he was just, we were both, I was too. I was like, it was one of these things where it's like, I had no idea it was going to work that well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it was one of these things where it's like, wow, if we teach him how to write that way, it's almost, it was just, you know, they performed 20 sketches and there were 20 funny sketches and we had never seen anything like that.
And was this the time that you were sort of finding that you were being pulled more in the direction of writing and directing rather than acting?
Well, I had been, that had been happening for a long, long time. I mean, I also started directing the Bravo Company, and I had already made the decision that I probably wouldn't do another show as an actor at Acme when I started directing the Bravo Company.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was, career-wise, I was finding a lot more success as a writer than I was as an actor. I was finding success in the voiceover world, but as a on-screen performer, the last commercial strike killed my career as an on-screen performer, because I was mostly a commercial actor, and the year that we had the commercial strike, I had five commercials.
Not the writer's strike, you're talking about the commercial.
Right, the commercial strike. I had five commercials on the air at the same time going into the commercial strike, and I only did one more on-camera commercial for the rest of my career after the commercial strike. It really, really killed
the momentum.
The momentum and just the way the commercials were done and how, I mean, just it really put a nail in the coffin of me being and because
tough,
because
commercials can be so lucrative and
yeah.
they can, like, you know, really set you up.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Stephanie Courtney, the Geico gal, mm-hmm. you know, she's set for life. But yeah, that's got to be really frustrating.
Yeah, and so, I mean, and I had just quit my job to my regular job and had decided I was going to be an actor full time. So it was a rough couple years there. But
so were you kind of doing a little soul searching and figuring out, like, maybe I'll transition to something else?
Yeah, or? And that was when I think right along that period, right in that period is when I became the director of the Bravo Company and in charge of the school at Acme. And I sold my first screenplay right around then, and I just found that I was able to work as a writer better than I was as an on-screen actor, mm-hmm. at the very least. And then, you know, just time went by, and I think one of the things that happened was because the people that I was bringing up through my sketch method were using that method, and it was such a consistent method, the Bravo Company shows started to outshine the main company shows. And it wasn't necessarily because I had better people. I had some phenomenal people. It was just that we were using a sketch method that was consistent. We were also doing things completely different than the main company was doing. The main company would work for 6 months to have a bunch of sketches and narrow it down to, and we would start with 20 sketches and cut three.
Yeah.
You know, because the method allowed us to go, we know these sketches will work, so we're going to workshop these sketches. We only did it for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. We had 2 weeks of shows where we worked and shaped them a little bit, and then we would cut two or three sketches, and then we would end up with a show that we would run for 10 to 12 weeks. And it was just so different than the way the main company was doing. And the shows, I mean, we were outselling the main company. You know, the main company show was, the tickets were higher, and yet we were making more money on the Bravo Company side of it. And I think it just, I think what kind of happened with Sweeney is he saw that happening. And I mean, we've talked about it a little bit, but he knew that he wasn't, you know, old dogs knew tricks. Yeah. Well, old dog knew tricks too. And he'd been doing it for a long time. And I think he felt that, it for him to try and learn how I was doing sketch would be very tough for him.
Yeah.
That would be something for him to direct and teach people to do that would be tough. And also that a lot of the people that were in the main company might not want to make that transition either, you know? So there was, and I think he was getting tired. He wanted to get into the restaurant business. And so he was looking to sell Acme. And at the time I had just sold two or three movies
that you'd written.
That I'd written. And I was the voice of Piglet. So I was making money.
Oh, we're
money
getting
on that
there.
Side. Yeah. You know, so I had the money and I decided to
make an offer.
To make an offer, and he took it. And
was this about the time that like Joel McHale and Alex Borstein were there? Were they in the main company when?
Well, they were in the main company. When Sweeney
and
was
Adam Carolla.
No, Adam Carolla was old school. Like Adam Carolla was a performer before I was there.
Okay.
Yeah, I was there for about 12 years, and Adam was way before my time. I had never, in my mind, bought Acme so that I could run Acme forever.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get Acme to the point where it was alive again and then I could have somebody else have it. And I wanted to franchise it. I wanted it to be like
Second City. Yeah.
You know, I wanted to have Acme, you know, New York and Acme, you know.
Yeah.
And
that would be so great.
I wanted to get I had a package together so that it would be easy to franchise. And we actually had a couple people who were interested in doing that. And I also was trying to take the IP that was being created at Acme and leverage that and make that into something that, you know, would work for television. And we had two different TV deals that because of the person I partnered with at the time, who you know,
mm-hmm.
Because I couldn't get him to realize how the industry worked, the two television deals that we had fell through.
Yeah, I remember you were telling us about
that. And that was kind of the nail in the coffin for me in that what I was tired of doing was I was tired of putting together shows that everybody was saying was brilliant for 99 people.
Right.
You know, I think like the real one for me was when I did 10 Little Indigenous Peoples. And that was a really fun, really amazing show. I had great actors, but we just put that show together so well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was absolutely packed to the gills every single performance for that run. And I thought to myself, so we sold 1,000 tickets for this show and probably 300 to 400 people saw it, you know, because a lot of those people were there the whole time.
Yeah.
Were coming every week. And I just said, I'm putting in so much energy to entertain these 400 people. I don't know that I'm making the best use of the years of my career.
Yeah.
I just felt like it wasn't the best use of my time. And that if my career was going to move forward, I had to let Acme go to a certain extent so that I wanted to expand my career and Acme at the same time. But if that wasn't going to happen, the career had to come first. And, you know, it was a very, very difficult decision to make. And of course, in retrospect, if I could go back in time, I wouldn't make that same decision now.
You wouldn't?
No.
You would have kept Acme?
I would have kept Acme. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I it hurts me that's my legacy.
Yeah.
Acme is my, you know, a legacy that is gone now.
Hey, you guys, I want to tell you a little bit about Kinsa, the world's smartest thermometer. It is truly designed to give parents peace of mind. And here's what it does. It remembers temperature, symptoms, and medications, and gives guidance on what to do next. It also has a really cool feature where it can send all that information to your child's doctor. What a helpful tool to have in your toolbox, especially when your little one isn't feeling well, you're running around thinking of a million other things. Kinsa remembers all of that for you. To find out more about Kinsa and the world's smartest thermometer, go to kinsahealth.com. bumbybox.com. And I want to tell you about BumbyBox, a better way to play. BumbyBox is an eco-friendly toy subscription service that sends award-winning toys tailored for your child's age and interest right to your door. Now, if you're anything like me, you have great memories of playing with your family growing up. I used to love to make mud pies with my mom. Well, BumbyBox can help create those beautiful new memories for you and your family. Go to BumbyBox.com to find out more and make sure you enter the code M-I-H-O-O-D at checkout to get 10% off. BumbyBox.com, a better way to play. Let's talk about Piglet for a second. Are you allowed to talk about Piglet?
Yeah, I'm allowed to talk.
There's no gag order on the Disney stuff.
There used to be. When I very first got it, there was.
I was going to say, how did that come to be? Because you are the voice of Piglet. Yeah. And that's very exciting.
Yeah, I've been the voice of a bunch of different characters over the years, but the only one that I've kind of hung on to has been Piglet. Yeah.
And how did that happen? Were you someone that played around with voices growing up?
Yeah. I always did voices growing up, and I always imitated voices and tried to, voice match, is what the industry would call it. It was Acme. I was doing a show at Acme. Same time that I met my agents, I met my wife, actually. She was working at that agency, and they liked me, and they signed me commercially, and they also signed me, me for voiceover.
Nice.
And then I auditioned like a full year before I got my first, Piglet was my first voiceover gig that I got from there.
Oh, wow. And then you booked the job. Wow.
Yeah. And then I booked a bunch of other stuff. But I mean, I auditioned for a full year before I got anything.
Are they making new Winnie the Pooh, animation?
Well, no. They made the movie that was a few years back. Yeah. What was that? 2013, I think, is when it came out. And then they did this thing called the Mini, M-I-N-I, Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, where they basically were just cutting scenes from existing material and then having the people who voiced the movie revoice those old materials so that there was a consistency of voice there. That is all that we have done in the past few years. When I first became the voice of Piglet, we were doing stuff constantly.
Yeah.
And then we had a television series and we were doing that. I've heard rumors of a live action Winnie the Pooh, where it's a live action movie where they're kind of, you know how they just did Jungle Book and Maleficent,
right,
where they were doing a live action Winnie the Pooh where Christopher Robin's all grown up and he comes back and finds his old toys and they come back to life again, kind of. But I don't know if they're going to use the original voices because Jungle Book didn't use any of the people who are doing
those voices.
So it's
not like you're under contract for any Piglet ever.
Right.
Because I think isn't the Mickey Mouse guy who voices Mickey Mouse?
Everybody who works for Disney, who is what's called the legacy voice for Disney.
Yeah, the legacy voice.
Everybody who is a contractor for every new thing we do, it's a new contract.
Okay.
So there's nobody. Mickey Mouse may have a special contract.
Sure.
It could be. But everybody else, I mean, because I know this is the case with Goofy and Donald, have every time we go in there, we sign a new contract for that specific job.
For that project. Interesting. Yeah. So it's possible then that they, if they decide to do the movie or a new, version of or whatever, they would audition other Piglets?
Yeah.
That's
bullshit. They did that with the
Don't do it, Disney.
With the movie that came out a few years back, that was just called, I think, Winnie the Pooh. That was the case with that one. The only two original, and I'm not an original voice, but the only two voices that were people who had done the voices previous to that film.
Yeah.
Were myself and Jim Cummings, who does Winnie the Pooh and Tigger. So it was just myself and Jim Cummings that did that film. That was actually kind of the moment where I think the industry, the cartoon aficionados out there in the universe went, okay, this guy's really Piglet.
Oh, good.
Yeah, because
they have to sort of accept you,
because
right?
I was moved forward with Jim, and then people all of a sudden were talking to me like, well, at least they kept, one of the original Piglets.
Yeah.
It's not, because there are only two people who've been Piglet who have voiced the there's one other guy who has been the voice of Piglet for singing when John Fiedler was doing the voice.
Mm-hmm.
He sang a few songs for him, I think, in Piglet's big movie. And obviously there have been people, there's like a guy who's fairly famous in Japan for doing Piglet.
So you don't do any of
Japanese
singing?
Piglet. Oh, no, I do. But I'm
you
saying,
do?
Oh, yeah, I sing as Piglet. But this was when John was getting older and he couldn't sing
right,
anymore.
Right.
So for Piglet's big movie, I know they got somebody who came in and sang for Piglet.
Do you talk to Evan in a Piglet voice?
You know, he loves Winnie the Pooh. He's never seen my film, the one that I've done, and I don't even know if he's seen any of the stuff that I've done. Like, I have a ton of Winnie the Pooh stuff that I've done.
I'm sure.
He really likes, you know how kids, they just gravitate to watch one film over and over again. He really likes Springtime for Roo, and he really likes the original The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh. And there's a Christmas special that he watches, those three. And I said to him one time, I did talk to him as Piglet and said, does this sound like Piglet? And he said, no, Daddy.
and you're like, oh, maybe well, I need to work
exactly.
on this stuff.
Exactly.
Are you allowed to do the Piglet voice outside of Disney? Oh, my God, do it.
Now, I don't know how much this will sound like it because
I'm judging you harshly.
I'm just telling you that they pitch it.
So they can tone it a little bit.
When John was doing it, he was just talking in his regular voice, and they pitched it up a bit and sped it up a bit. So with me, because of the way technology works, they don't have to pitch and speed up. When I talk, they can just pitch it up electronically.
Because you naturally have such a deep voice.
I do not.
You're blushing a little bit right now. Are you nervous?
A deep voice?
Yeah.
I'm like the voice of a
gravelly.
Teenage girl's.
You don't have the voice.
Well, that's because it's earlier in the day, but
for you. okay.
It's hard to be brave when you're such a small animal. Oh. So imagine that pitched up slightly. It's only 10%, but it's pitched up slightly.
Oh, that's so great. And I bet Evan is just like, one day he'll fully appreciate it.
One day he'll fully. Of course, by the time, you know, who knows how everything works at Disney. But I mean, I've been Piglet for over 15 years now. But who knows how things work at Disney? Maybe by the time he's older, I won't be Piglet anymore. Who knows? But I think they're pretty happy with what I do. But,
yeah.
But you know.
F them if they're not. That's what I say. F Disney. No, I'm just kidding. We love Disney.
We love Disney.
Everyone has to say that. Disney is like the mafioso. Like, you must love Disney or you will never work in this town.
Well,
again.
And
they own everything.
I will say this. Disney has been very good to me, and mm-hmm. they've been a great company to work for. It is very exciting to be part of something like that. You know, to be part of something that is known worldwide. I mean, I'm probably the most famous for being the voice of Piglet than anything else, because my voice is heard all over the world as that particular character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go and you visit Disney World and you go to the Piglet ride and you knock on Piglet's house, you're going to hear my voice. If you go to Japan, you're going to hear my voice, you know, and the Disney there are a couple countries that I like. I don't do the Spanish Disney version of Piglet, and I don't do the Japanese version of Piglet.
Hola, but yo soy Piglete.
Exactly.
Oh. See, I could do it.
but you know, any English speaking country around the world, my voice is being heard.
That's so cool.
And toys.
It's like
and so forth.
It's like they call. I mean, like you said, the name. They're actually called legacy voices. I mean, mm-hmm. there's something kind of romantically Hollywood about that. Like, mm-hmm. it is a legacy voice.
And they call them that because they try to keep the legacy of the voice alive. In that, even now, as long as I've been doing this voice, and I kind of consider it like. You know, that's my Piglet's mine now. You know,
right.
That's how I feel about it.
Right.
Although I still have only been Piglet half as long as John Fiedler was. But even now, if I go in and I do a toy or something specific, they will play me original Piglet to get my ear.
Get it in your ear.
Because they want it to sound. They want legacy voices to sound like they've sounded forever.
Consistent.
They want Mickey Mouse to sound like what Mickey Mouse sounded like in 1932. They want Piglet to sound exactly like he sounded like in 1960. 3. Wow. You know, so it's.
But that's one of the great things about Disney is because they know what their fans love.
Right.
The nostalgia of some of the earlier stuff that they've done. And that feeling that it brings to people, whether it's in a voiceover or like visually in an animation or at the park. I was talking about this on my podcast a couple of weeks ago, is just how there's something very special about Disneyland and the way that they do their park and give you that feeling of magic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's down to the detail. That's where Disney, I think, succeeds, is in the details.
Yeah. And I think even the people at Disney would probably acknowledge this to a certain extent. It was also, there was something about Walt Disney. I mean, Walt Disney was one of, you know, we used to have this thing of like, who are the three most influential people who ever lived? And I would say Disney is mm-hmm. one of the three most influential people who ever lived.
Absolutely.
He was a visionary, and he was a creative force probably unlike anything that we've seen certainly within our lifetimes, like within the modern era. You would probably have to go back to a Shakespeare or to a maybe to H.G. Wells before you find another person who was so influential and changed the industry and changed the way we look at the creative universe more than Disney did. Mm-hmm. You know, he created cartoons for adults, basically.
Yeah.
He created full-length cartoons. He created the theme park. He created, he created almost created family entertainment as a viable entertainment method.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was, before Disney, there wasn't anything like what they did, you know, I mean, he took so many chances that could have been horrible failures throughout mm-hmm. his lifetime. I mean, I one of the saddest things is he died young.
Yeah.
You know, if he had lived another 20 years, I can't imagine what else he would have, because if you go to Disneyland, the rides that he created, that he oversaw, are still the best rides at Disneyland.
Yeah.
You know, and I know the people over, over there, and I, you know, no offense to them, but my kid still was the most drawn to the Haunted House and to Small World and to Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, those were the things he loved the most, and those were all Walt Disney creations, you know, I mean, he's pretty amazing.
I took Channing on Small World a couple of months ago. Pirates of the Caribbean. And as we were going through it, it was just the two of us, I was like, oh, this might be a little scary for her. There's a few darker parts. I mean, she's only 2.5, so I was like, oh, I don't know. And she just kind of watched everything, and she was real quiet. And we get off, and we're walking out, and I'm holding her hand, and I was like, did you like that? And she goes, that was kind of scary, but I liked it. And I was like, I think that's because it's scary, but it still has that childlike hint of fun and like excitement.
And it's also wonderment. And there is a sense that what's happening there isn't going to jump on the boat.
Right. You're not terrified.
Yeah. It's not like those 3D rides where it feels like it's coming right at
you.
Right. Which there's still like this feeling of safety about it. But I mean, to give you an idea of how far ahead Disney was thinking. When he filmed The Wonderful World of Disney, the television show, he filmed it in color, on color film. This was when television was in black and white, mm-hmm. okay? And his people asked him at the time, why are we doing this on color film? Why are we, you know, everybody else is doing video, and why are we doing this on color film? It's so much more expensive. And he said, because eventually there is going to be color television. And when there is, I want to be able to have an entire catalog that I can replay that is in color, and we will be right on the forefront. So he said that at a time when there was no color television and no reruns.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And that's what he was thinking.
Yeah.
So his ability to foresee where we would be going with that. I mean, that's amazing. And they were much more expensive. I mean, not just a little bit more expensive.
A lot more. Yeah.
They were like three or four times what a normal show would cost.
Do you think he was a time traveler?
If he was a time traveler, he probably wouldn't have smoked so much.
Oh yeah. Ooh,
you know, you know what I'm saying? That was like his one failing.
Because I
know
you also have a little inner nerdy. You know,
oh yes, very nerdy. Very nerdy. Yeah. In fact,
I love it. Oh yes, very nerdy.
Well, I mean, who was it? Somebody used to say that like I'm the secret hidden king of the nerds.
Yeah.
Because if you do a Venn diagram of all the people I know and all the things places I've worked, I am like the central nexus point of some of the biggest nerd things in the world. Like, you know, I mean, obviously Will Wheaton and Felicia Day were students and good friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But I have numerous friends who are in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah.
Did you
watch that documentary recently that Shatner did on Star Trek? What did you think about that?
Oh, I liked it.
I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
I was surprised to find out just how much drama was going on behind the
scenes in the early seasons.
Honestly, throughout the whole show.
Will had privately told me a lot of the stuff that was happening.
Yeah, they didn't really talk to him a whole lot.
Next Generation was happening. So
oh my gosh.
I knew a lot of the stuff about like the whole, and it was pretty, it was, I mean, Will was very close with Gene Roddenberry, because Gene placed his character there as a version of himself.
Like he
that was kind of him living vicariously through Wesley Crusher's character. So he got real close to Gene. But I worked with, and I'm for years I was friends with Luke Skywalker himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we used to do voiceover work.
And
we used to hang out in the parking lot and talk. So I know a bunch of people from the Star Wars universe. I've worked in comic books and superhero stuff. And like
in terms of writing or?
In terms of writing, just the people that I know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I used to write for video games. I worked at numerous video game places.
Do you ever feel, knowing all of these, you know, famous people and all of the connections you've made in animation and directing, writing and all that stuff, do you ever wish that you yourself had more notoriety and more quote unquote fame in the business?
I wish my career was further along than it was, definitely, my directing career especially.
Mm-hmm.
It's frustrating. It's difficult to break in as a director. I don't know that I would want to be more famous.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of famous friends.
Yeah.
And their lives are not necessarily enriched by their fame.
Mm-hmm. Mine would be, just for the record.
I think that's one of the reasons why I stopped pursuing an on-camera career, because I think I really enjoy being the power behind. Like when I was at Acme, I loved looking at what was there and going, I created all this,
mm-hmm.
and I'm responsible for what's happening on stage and the success that's here. And I know I taught all these people how to do this, and yet I don't have to be the one that everybody's coming to afterwards, or I'm not the one on stage.
Right.
I enjoy the anonymity of it.
Okay.
You know, for example, I wrote and directed a film, but nobody's going to stop me on the street and want to have a conversation about that film.
Yeah.
Because, you know, 50% of them will want to tell me off about it. You know, I mean, it's not necessarily always going to be a good conversation, and it's, you know, most people couldn't pick the director of Batman versus Superman out of a crowd.
Right.
You know, they just wouldn't know what he looks like. But that wouldn't be the case for the stars.
Now, one of the other things that you do that I find really fascinating is your punch-up work.
Mm-hmm.
How?
Now that's really anonymous.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, talk about like the unsung hero of a screenplay, you know. You know, you have your writer, the person who writes it, and then you got the guy or gal who comes in and either makes it funnier or more dramatic or, you know, whatever. What do you do as a punch-up writer?
Well, you do exactly that. You come in, and what I am usually for is one of two things. I am either to make the dialogue seem more natural, like two people are actually talking, mm-hmm. or I'm brought in to try and make things funnier. I'm brought in usually for one of those two things. Not very often both, but usually for one of those two things. Like when I was brought in to the movie Planes, I was brought in to make it funnier. I don't know that in the end they kept enough of what I did to do that.
Yeah.
And I also was brought in later to almost everything that the, I don't know if you've seen the movie, but it's about a plane race mostly. Everything that's said by the guys who are calling the race, the sports type talk. All of that is stuff I wrote. Now, I'm not listed anywhere on Planes.
Yeah, I was
I'm not
say,
in the credits for Planes at all.
Why? Is that not part of your contract, or it's just not something they
when
do?
When you're brought in to be a when you punch up something, or you're or you are being paid for your anonymity. So there are some movies I've worked on that I can't even say on this podcast that I've worked on.
Star Wars, The Force Awakens?
No, okay. No. But there are some big comedies that I've worked on where some of the jokes up there on the screen are my jokes.
Yeah.
And I'm not allowed to say which ones those are.
Will you tell me when we stop recording?
I can tell you when we stop recording.
If I swear, I will only write it on my blog and not anywhere else. No.
Well, you can't write it anywhere.
Nowhere.
But I mean, I can tell you a couple. I mean, but there's some that I can't even tell you.
That's so interesting.
I mean, what's funny is my agent can. Like, because obviously I have to get work, so they have to be able to say. And there are a few things I do put out. Like Planes, for example, is one of those where I'm not sworn to secrecy on. Yeah. So I actually put that on a resume and say,
sure.
You know, I worked there for a while and I worked on Planes. But I definitely wish that my punch up work, because I think I would have a very different, I think people
I think
in
would
the,
totally have a different
in
career.
The industry would probably view me very differently if they knew how many famous films I've
How many
on.
Of them, have any of them gone on to win like awards?
Oh yeah.
Oh my God. Like, so you have worked on like Academy Award or Emmy Award winning or Golden Globe winning projects.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how frustrating is that for you to be sitting there like, really, mother truckers? Like,
well, it has gotten to the point in my career where I'm starting to choose projects by what I can get a credit on.
Yeah.
My frustration was when I was at Disney, when I was working on Planes, is I was actually head writer of another project. Mm-hmm. But that project went into turnaround, and the director was let go. And as a result, I stopped working on it. But what they did after that, which bear little to no resemblance of what I was working on, mm-hmm. through no fault of my own, was completely different. So right. I didn't get a credit on that. And that, right. and the whole reason I was working on Planes was for the hope that I would get a writing credit
on
that
other
project.
Oh,
so it was
so
like,
frustrating.
Yeah. So it was just one of those things where it's like, oh, I just cannot.
Don't you just feel like though, since you've seen almost all sides of this business right. now, from acting, directing, writing, animation, all of that, there's a constant disappointment where you're like, at some point, you're striving to get to that end goal and what you want. And it just seems like somebody with more power, talking about wanting to be in control right. and being power, somebody with more power and control is always in your way.
Yeah, I mean, and I've
holding
had,
you back.
I also have had like a, my career is full of some really amazing misses. So yeah, I had a movie called Armageddon that was on the blacklist 2 years in a row. That film was sold 3 times and greenlit twice. Now, normally when you're greenlit in the industry, that means your film's going to be made. Mm-hmm. And I had mine greenlit twice, same film, and it didn't get made.
Different production companies? Or?
First, it was New Line, and we had a table read. Let me tell you who was at that table read. The table read, the movie is a spoof on disaster films. It's a movie where a impending ice age, a asteroid colliding with Earth, and an alien invasion is all happening at the exact same time. and so it mostly spoofs Armageddon, Deep Impact, ID4, and The Day After Tomorrow, which was all recent films back
right.
when I wrote it. And at the table read was Bruce Willis. Mm-hmm. playing himself, the president, and his stunt double. It was the fellow from Apollo 13.
Gary Sinise.
Nope.
Tom Hanks.
Nope. Guy who was in charge of ground control.
Ed Harris. Oh my God, I love Ed Harris.
Ed Harris playing.
That's one of my favorite movies of all time. So.
Yeah, Ed Harris basically spoofing the role that he played in that film because he was NASA. Uh-huh. Jeff Goldblum playing Secretary of State. The lead characters were played by Bradley Cooper. And the girl from Zach and Mira Make a Porno,
Elizabeth Banks. Yeah,
that was the core cast at the table read.
Wow,
for that movie. All right.
Yeah,
there was a bunch of other famous people there, but those people were the core cast at a table read for my film.
Oh my God,
these were the people who were going to be in that movie. Okay.
Wow.
The New Line people said it was the funniest table read they'd ever seen. And the guy who was in charge of New Line at the time, Bob Shea, who was fired a year later, didn't think the script was very funny. Mm. And he told the guy who was overseeing, the executive who now runs New Line, that if he did the movie and it didn't do well, it was his head.
Oh wow! So they took it off the.
So they went from fast tracking the movie to putting it into turnaround. Bruce Willis came up to me and said it was one of the funniest films he had ever read.
That's nice.
Then we immediately sold it to Screen Gems. It was greenlit again. They did a contract with Ed Harris, pay or play, and over the weekend the head of New Line. The head of Screen Gems decided that it was too expensive. And we were greenlit on Friday and ungreenlit on Monday, but nobody told legal. So Ed Harris's contracts were signed. So they paid $1 million for that film.
For a movie you never made.
For the movie that they didn't make.
Wow, this town is ridiculous.
It was then, when it turned around, it was immediately sold to Brandenburg Studios in Germany. And I don't know what ever happened with it after that, because I stopped caring.
Oh my God, that's got to be so frustrating, especially after you've labored over something so long, and you get so close to, you know.
Yeah. Yep.
I think as actors, sometimes we forget when we go out on an audition, even if it's a pilot or something like that, we go out and we say, this is it. This is my big life-changing role, you know, and we audition for it a few times, and then if it doesn't move forward, behind that is a writer and a producer or showrunner who has been working on it for months or years to try to get it, you know, to go. It's good to put things in perspective.
I mean, the whole reason I went out and made an independent film was just to have a writing credit. The most frustrating thing, because there's two main things that I've done throughout my career. I also wrote pilots for years. I wrote 6 pilots in 3 years that I sold.
Did any of them go on to air?
No. But the problem is each one of them was on IMDb while it was a pilot.
Yeah.
Then when it didn't get picked up, they're yanked off of IMDb. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I do a lot of punch-up work. And again, because I don't get a credit for that, it doesn't show up on IMDb. I have worked on... And then there's other stuff that just doesn't show up on IMDb because I don't know why. Like, I did an episode of My Friends Tigger and Pooh as a writer. That's never showed up on IMDb, and I don't even know why.
I think it's because you either have to go in and put it on yourself.
Well, some of it, yeah, and I'm not very good
at that.
Because
if the production company isn't on the ball.
Because there's numerous cartoons I've written episodes for, and of course nothing that I did for G4, and I created some shows for G4. Mm-hmm. None of that's on IMDb.
My friend Christian used to work for G4. He said he wrote the monologue for a few years, or the main, or on Attack of the Show, or Attack
could,
the
could
Show.
Be, yeah.
He was the monologue writer or something.
Yeah, but I mean, I created and literally wrote the scripts for numerous shows on that show, and none of that showed up on IMDb. But I think part of the reason for that was I had to be listed as a producer. It was a non-union thing, so I had to be listed as a producer.
IMDb is a tricky thing.
But the long story short, I have worked on at least 20 television shows that I can think offhand. I have sold 8 pilots. I have worked on 30 films at least. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that's on IMDb as a writer for me is the one film that I went and did independently as a writer-director.
Yeah.
Because, and that was the biggest reason I did that was literally to get a credit out there on IMDb, because it was driving me nuts, because I would tell people I was a writer and then they would go look, because unfortunately people use IMDb as a measure
gauge.
Of whether you're being mm-hmm. a bullshit artist or not. And they would look me up and there would be very little on there to indicate that I was a writer. So they would think that I didn't do much. And yet, yeah. and yet, you know, I bought Acme off of being a writer.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what kills me. I feel like
maybe you need to go in and just put them on IMDb yourself.
Well, and the other thing is, too, when you sell scripts and they don't get made, that doesn't show up on IMDb
either.
No, yeah,
that's true.
So I've sold like 7 films to major studios that don't show up there because
I think,
and each one of those is a fairly significant paycheck.
I feel like though that's just part of the unsung hero that is the writer.
I guess. I mean,
the writers never get as much credit as the actors do,
and or the directors.
Or the directors.
I mean, they really are. The writer really is the least respected and least powerful part of the.
Process. Which is interesting.
The producer is more powerful. The director is more powerful. The actors are more powerful. I would say in many cases, the cinematographer and the heads of departments are more powerful than the writer. They're the last people often to be thought of, especially in big budget films.
Yeah.
They'll go and start production without a script. The big thing from last weekend, Batman versus Superman, had a complete crap script.
Yes, you know, everyone says.
You know,
I haven't seen it yet.
And yet they spent like $250 million on that film. They couldn't have really said, you know, we should probably have a really good script. I mean, there are really...
It doesn't matter. People don't care about that. They want to see action.
And unfortunately, that's the problem, though. But when you do a good... I still say there is a big difference between a crappy scripted movie that goes out there and makes a lot of money... And a Guardians of the Galaxy, which is a big budget film that had a great script.
So great.
You know.
Such a fun movie.
And they can be that. They can all be that.
Yeah,
you know?
It can be both.
You have, when you're making a film that is that big, you can have scripts that are that good. You can shop around. You can get writers that have that ability to write those scripts.
Yeah.
A lot of it is producers that don't have the ear or the eye for a good script, directors that do not necessarily have an ear or an eye for a good script, you know, because the script has to make it past those two people, even when you sell it. Mm-hmm. I have sold scripts and then watched them turn into something completely different.
Yeah.
Throughout the process. Through no fault of my own.
Maybe somebody went and punched up your script.
Well, or completely rewrote it.
Or completely rewrote it, yeah.
You know, and as in one case. You know, and I would have ended up getting the credit for that, but it wouldn't have been my work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like there's so much more that we could talk about. I have so many questions, especially like the nerd stuff and like the writing and stuff like that. I feel like we could probably sit here for a few hours and talk, but everybody would be like, Jesus, wrap it up.
Exactly.
So thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Absolutely. Anytime.
And sharing your infinite wisdom and experience. I know you don't tweet very much.
I don't.
You're terrible at social media.
I am on social media. I'm going on Twitter right now to look up what my Twitter handle is.
You don't know?
I'm telling
Travis,
you,
that's terrible.
Isn't it?
We live in a day and age where everybody has to be.
I'm at Travis_Oates.
All right, everybody, mark that down. Travis_Oates. Yeah, I follow you. I'm on there. Everybody go find Travis. Also, you're not on Facebook though, or anything like that.
Not on Facebook.
You're doing Vine or
terrible.
YouTube stuff.
I don't do any of the social media stuff.
I'm going to go and look for some still frames of of beachcombers and what's the other one? Danger Bay.
You're not going to find any. You're not going to find anything. You'll be able to find. You won't find anything with me on beachcombers. I mean, if you really went through every Danger Bay, and I don't know which one I'm on, you might. I said, so just one. I was just on one episode.
I'm going to Google it. If anybody else out there finds it, yeah. Go look through beachcombers.
Well, the problem with beachcombers is that was before everything went online. And I've looked for myself.
Yeah.
I've looked for myself to try and find some stuff for myself. And I haven't been able
There's
got to
be
yet.
Some fans out there somewhere, somebody who has access to it or has a way to find it.
If you got like 1983 and 1984, I think.
All right.
Beachcombers.
Yeah. All right. Everybody, you have a mission. Go and find it.
Go. Good luck.
Thanks again, Travis. And everybody, make sure you go to motherhoodinhollywood.com to find out more information about Travis and also his Twitter. And make sure you subscribe to Motherhood in Hollywood if you haven't already. And follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Love you guys. Have a great week. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Balls.